Dr. Stephen Davey is the senior pastor at Colonial Baptist Church and the president of the Shepherd's Theological Seminary, as well as the principal Bible teacher on the Wisdom for the Heart broadcast. He attended Liberty University and Tennessee Temple University, graduating in 1981. He holds a Master of Divinity degree from Detroit Baptist Theological Seminary and a Master of Sacred Theology degree from Dallas Theological Seminary. He's been honored with a Doctor of Divinity degree from an STS sister seminary in Chennai, India. He presently maintains a full schedule, leading shepherds, directing Wisdom for the Heart, heard on 5 continents throughout the USA on 241 radio stations and Transworld Radio, and fulfilling his primary ministry duties as pastor-teacher of Colonial Baptist Church. He's written 3 commentaries and numerous smaller books published by Charity House, Ambassador, Emerald House Publishers, and Wisdom for the Heart. And on a more personal note, I've not met Stephen Davey before, but had the privilege just to eat dinner with him this evening and commend him to you as a man who loves the church, as a man who is a joy to hear his testimony, his passion to preach the word, to build the church, and to encourage you. So please, welcome Dr. Stephen Davey as he comes.
I knew right away I liked him because of that red hair. My hair used to be red. You're going to have to use your imagination, but it used to be that color. And his is wavy, and mine wave goodbye. But we had a great time, and I just love this setting. I love what I've heard from Chris and Ron, and their heart for you as a flock, and a love for the Word. I so commend you for being here on a weeknight like this. It shows your hunger for the Word of God, and it's an honor to be here. Now I did hear it's going to snow tomorrow. Is that right? It's going to snow supposedly in Raleigh as well, 2 inches. So what that means is that right now at this very moment, there isn't any bread or milk left in any store anywhere in my county. It's gone. And I'm going to be here. So I hope it doesn't snow, but if it does, so we'll still show up. And if it doesn't, that's great. Well, we're going to spend some time together in one particular passage. And before I have you turn there, one of my staff pastors sent me a couple of years ago an illustration that I thought might be a good way to begin. A modern-day shepherd was standing on the side of the road on one occasion tending his flock, scattered all over the hillside by a dirt road. And at one point, an SUV, brand new SUV, pulls up, slows down and stops, and this young businessman rolls his window down and says, "Hey, are you a shepherd?" And the guy said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "You know, I've always been fascinated with you guys. The hours you keep, the work you do, the labor of love for your flock, it so impresses me." He said, "You know, if I could tell you how many sheep you have, would you give me one of them?" And the shepherd kind of smiled and said, "Sure, go ahead." Well, he got out of his SUV, walked around to the back, flipped the tailgate up, pulled out a laptop, tied into a NASA site, put in some commands, plugged that into a portable printer, spit out this information, and he came back to the shepherd and he said, "You have exactly 1,357 sheep." And the shepherd said, "You're right. That's amazing." And the man put, one of the animals in his SUV. He's about to drive away, and the shepherd went up and knocked on his window, and he stopped, rolled his window down, and the shepherd said, "Look, if I could tell you what you do for a living, would you pay me back?" And the guy kind of smiled, and he said, "Sure, go ahead and try." The shepherd said, "You're a business consultant." And he said, That's right. That's amazing. How did you know?" He said, "Well, it was easy. First of all, you came to the place where I work to give me advice without being invited. Second of all, you told me something I already knew and then charged me for it. And third, you don't know anything about my business, and I'd really like to have my dog back." I can tell you as a pastor, and I know that Chris would say the same in your elder team, I get information in my mailbox almost every day on church, on leadership, on ministry, written by, for the most part, people that do not know the difference between a dog and a sheep. You know, there are a lot of con artists in our world today, and they don't bother me in the community. They bother me in the church. In fact, some of the severe warnings from Paul and others had to do with those rising up within the church at large, not necessarily one local church, that happened too, but within the church at large, who said, we speak for God and we have something to deliver to you. And they lead people astray. I so commend you to have these conferences which answer the question, and that is the church taught enough? And the answer is no. We're taught too little. And so what we're going to do is just spend some extra time in the letter from Paul to Titus as he talks about how to really shepherd the flock and what that looks like. And he's going to talk about every member of the family as well. Older men, we'll have a session on them. Older women, younger women, and young men. But I want to begin at chapter 1, which sort of sets the stage for the need to define those roles within the local church by just sort of beginning this discussion on con artists, false teachers. Now, if you do any research, which I did, which means I Googled con artists, you'll come up with more than you can begin to read. But I did come across a couple. One con artist in the early 1900s sold a device that he claimed would print a perfect counterfeit $100 bill, which was a lot of money then, a lot of money now. These people, of course, were fascinated with his concept of a paper copier. His name is not Xerox, by the way, but it was that idea. He convinced people to purchase this device, and he practiced. He showed them how it worked, and sure enough, outspit a $100 bill, and nobody could tell the difference. He would sell it for $30,000, which in today's economy would be about $400,000. Well, that'd be easy money. It'd be paid back soon. He designed the contraption, as he told these people he was scamming, that it would spit out a $100 bill every 6 hours. And then he demonstrated the first one. Sure enough, out came a perfect $100 bill. They'd pay quick money, and he'd leave it with them. He, however, had inserted into the device two genuine $100 bills. The first one spat out as he demonstrated it, and then he had 6 hours to get away before the next one spat out, and another six before empty paper just came out. It's a great con and a scam, and until he was caught, he made an awful lot of money. Internet sources are constantly pushing their scams. I had two not too long ago come up on my screen. One of them said, earn a college degree at home without taking any examinations. Oh, man, why wasn't that around when I was going through school? I could have used that. Another one said, earn $5,000 a week working from home part-time. Just send in your money and we'll send a kit to tell you how. And that person sending you the kit is making $5,000, by the way, part-time at home. You know, scam artists isn't a new problem. In fact, listen to the prophet Micah. Micah warned the people about them when he wrote, they dream up crimes while lying in bed, and as soon as it's morning light, full of energy, they put their schemes into practice. Micah chapter 2, verse 1. Now, it's one thing for a con artist to scam people out of, you know, money, to cause people to lose their shirt. It's another thing entirely to cause people to lose their spiritual equilibrium or their direction or maybe their soul. Con artists in the spiritual community are very common today. In fact, I couldn't help but think of the ultimate con artist. Satan, who wraps his lies with good sounding language and robes of truth, and he misleads people. Well, how do you spot a spiritual con artist as Paul lays the groundwork to then begin to tell them the truth about how to be an older man, an older woman, a younger woman, and a younger man that honors God? Well, he gives us three descriptions of men and women who lead the church astray. So I want you to go to verse 10 of chapter 1. And you'll notice he characterizes them by writing, "For there are many rebellious men." Rebellious. That word refers to someone who claims authority that is not really theirs. They claim authority in spiritual matters, although it shows up in my translation as rebellious. It's actually someone who claims to be obeying God, who is in fact claiming authority as a representative of God, which they do not have. Their favorite phrases will be things like, "God told me to tell you ABC. I speak for God like no one else. The church can't argue with me because I have authority and I alone am the true source of insight." Now get this, the Bible, and this is where it gets dangerous, the Bible is a resource for them. They'll use biblical language, but the Bible is not the source for them. They will use biblical language, but they will not teach the Bible. Watch them on television. Set your clock. They may wave their Bible in the air. They may thump it, talk about it, quote it, maybe every so often, but they're not going to teach you what it says. It's a resource, but it is not the source of their teaching. I grew up in one particular circle, and the favorite verse of men seemed to be 1 Chronicles 16:22, which reads, "Touch not God's anointed." In other words, I'm off limits. So anybody that comes along claiming to be a spiritual authority, claiming to speak for God, who is unaccountable, is a danger. Someone sent me a video link a few months ago of a church service where several thousand people were exuberantly cheering for their pastor. A visiting evangelist had come to speak, and he was saying all sorts of nice things about this particular gentleman. And they sent me the link because I'd read about this gentleman in the newspapers. But they brought up on stage these large, what they claim to be a Torah scroll, the law, first five books of the Old Testament. And it was wrapped in these holders that were about this tall. And they unrolled it a little bit, and then they had the pastor stand right inside it, and then they wrapped it around him. Then the evangelist said some things that were, somewhat exaggerating about the man and somewhat heretical, and then unwrapped it and had the pastor step forward, and the evangelist said that now this pastor is uniquely anointed to speak with the same divine authority as the Word of God. Then they put him in a chair, lifted the chair up on the shoulders of five or six men, paraded him around the stage while everyone cheered, and the evangelist claiming that we now have a new prophet. Never mind that he was under investigation for all kinds of financial fraud and sexual immorality, and it seemed all too convenient that he was now being told, the congregation was being told, he's off limits. Don't touch him. Don't say anything about him. Even the Apostle Paul, beloved, was not above accountability, right? It's one of the blessings, by the way, of your church having a plurality of men. Even though I'm the teaching pastor, there are 17 other men who are equally responsible. Even Paul at the council was deferential to other leaders. But what makes these men, and I would add women, so dangerous is the context here in Titus 1. They're rising up from within the body, the larger church, perhaps even a local church. So they are professing believers. They are not unbelievers. They're not coming into the church saying, by the way, I don't believe in Jesus. I don't believe, you know, the gospel. I believe all that stuff, but I've got a new word. And they're unaccountable in their personality. Secondly, they're also known by their empty promises. If you notice verse 10, he further describes these false teachers as empty talkers. You notice that? And by the way, this is the only time this adjective is found in the entire New Testament. It refers to someone who uses impressive language but has little content. They're fluent, but they're shallow. They're great at making speeches, but when you evaluate the content of their speeches, there's nothing quite there. One author who commented on this text said, you can always spot them by the way they so beautifully say absolutely nothing. They're smooth, they're pleasant, they're persuasive, they're captivating. But if you try to pin them down on some kind of doctrinal content or absolute dogmatic truth relative to the gospel, you're going to find they just do all kinds of shifting and moving. I watched one false teacher who pastors a large church who was asked by a television host to give answers to some very clear biblical issues, questions about a variety of issues, whether it was the gospel or homosexuality or any number of issues the Bible speaks to. And rather than provide biblical answers to really easy questions because of what God has already said, he dodged the issue, and time again he would say, I just don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I'll leave that to God. I don't know. It would be tragic enough if the world never asked the church for answers to questions the Bible delivers an answer to. It is even more tragic when the world asks the question and church leaders refuse to give an answer. There's an even greater danger bound up in this phrase, though. He's an empty talker. In other words, what he says actually has no true spiritual value. They're smooth words without spiritual wisdom. There's a powerful book called Christless Christianity by Michael Horton. And he explains that Christless Christianity doesn't mean that you don't mention Christ. It doesn't mean it's devoid of words like Jesus and sin and salvation and heaven. Christless Christianity, Horton defines, is the way those names are used when they are removed from their biblical contexts of redemption. So a false teacher will use cliches. He will say he believes the Bible. He might even end a sermon by saying you need to ask Jesus into your heart. He needs to become your savior. But you need to ask the question, what is he saving you from? Is it a bad job? Is it a smaller house and you would like to be, you know, rescued into a bigger house? Is it bad health? In fact, Dr. Horton extensively evaluated the content of messages preached by popular speakers and authors like Joel Osteen, Joyce Meyer, T.D. Jakes, Kenneth Copeland, and more. He wrote that they may wrap up their sermons with some language that sounds orthodox, but when you evaluate their messages, they are unorthodox. They have nothing to do with a real Savior and real redemption and real sin and a real hell to avoid and a heaven to win. He went on as an illustration to talk about when he and his wife were raising their triplets. They had triplets. Now, I have twins. They're 32 now, so I survived. But I used to have red hair. Did I mention that? But he had triplets, so I don't imagine that shoot me in the head. But at any rate, he had triplets. And He said that some of their best parenting advice came from a barber he had and his wife, who are unbelievers. And he makes the point, you don't need the Bible in order to know that your children need regular sleep patterns, that the secret of a good marriage is talking to each other every so often, that divorce is devastating, that you shouldn't let your credit cards rule over you and all that. And he made the point, he said, you know, someone can lose weight, stop smoking, improve one's marriage, and become a nicer person without Jesus. You don't have to have Jesus to do those things. In other words, if Christianity is nothing more than marital advice, parental advice, financial advice, and all that, how different are we from other religions that give the same advice? What distinguishes Christianity is not its moral or marital or financial guidelines, and the scriptures do speak to those. What's unique is the gospel. What's unique is that everything flows out of the context of us as repentant and redeemed, reconciled children of God by faith alone in Christ alone, because of the grace of God alone. We discovered that in the scriptures alone, ultimately for the glory of God alone, right? You had that Solas conference. But what does the false teacher focus on? How to get heaven down here now? How to get your glorified body now? How to get some of that gold asphalt down here now? For them, heaven is anticlimactic. In fact, you don't even need it. What about sin and redemption and Christ as the crucified atoning lamb for sinners slain? That is uniquely Christian. A con artist gives you something you think you want, but then you realize it won't satisfy. I mean, you think about it. If money made you happy, the richest people on the planet should be the happiest, and the poorest people on the planet should be sad. But we know that isn't true, is it? If good health made you happy, then sick people would never smile. And bodybuilders would never stop smiling, right? I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger would be one happy guy. He might be, I don't know. He just hits people a lot from what I've seen. But a con artist gives you something you think you might want, and he promises you something that when you get it, you realize it didn't pan out after all. And they've had 6 hours to get away. One of the reasons there's always going to be a market for spiritual con artists is because our hearts pander after whatever they happen to be peddling. We do want heaven now. We do want health now. We do want money now. We do want pleasure now. We don't want problems anymore. If people got everything these empty talkers promised, frankly, we wouldn't need heaven. So this is sort of the setup here. This is the character of the con artist. They're known for their unaccountable personalities. You can't mess with them. They're heavily guarded. They're known for their empty promises. Thirdly, they're known as deceptive promoters. In fact, he writes further here in verse 10 that there are many rebellious men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision. You could render that literally, they are out of the circumcision, which means that they're, in this generation, especially dangerous because they're coming out of Judaism. They're Jewish converts to Christianity. But then what they're doing is they're causing havoc by wanting Gentiles to become Jews. In fact, the book of Acts is going to spend a lot of time dealing with the issue of the Jewish and Gentile believers reaching agreement on the gospel of the new covenant, this brand new organism called the church, because the false teachers wanted Gentiles to become Jews in order to become Christian. And so they're demanding that Gentiles be circumcised, adhere to the Sabbath, abstain from eating non-kosher meat, adhere to the ceremonial law, the Mosaic law, bow to rabbinical teachings, and on and on and on and on. To put it very simply, what they're teaching is that Jesus is not enough if you want to go to heaven. You got to keep these rules. By the way, that's morphed over the years. It still exists today. Jesus isn't enough. You got to have Jesus plus something. Baptism, church membership, philanthropy, keep your nose clean, do good things, don't be a mass murderer, whatever it is. It's Jesus plus if you ever hope to get in. Jesus is not enough. And the next phrase, because Paul doesn't want to take this sitting down, notice, he tells Titus in very strong words, they must be silenced. The word means to be muzzled. They got to be muzzled. And the present tense refers to a continuous action, which lets you know here then that the true elder shepherd is never off duty, watching out for and alert to false teaching. Titus, he's saying, these con artists need to be caught. You need to catch them. You need to expose them. You need to maybe even mention them by name. But you need to silence them, literally muzzle them, not by the way, literally gagging them. Don't, you know, catch them and hide them in a closet and gag them. You answer them. That's what he's talking about. You respond to their error with the truth. That's why you go back in verse 9. An elder must be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. These are the false teachers. And this has really bothered Paul. He sent Titus here on assignment to the island of Crete, a tough place to minister. But the Cretans were descendants of pirates. How's that for a congregation? And Paul tells us that there are two results of these false teachers having their way, and it's ongoing. It's actually taking place here. Number one, families are being turned upside down. Verse 11, first part. It must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families. The word upsetting is the same word you find in Matthew 21:12, where we're told that Jesus turned over the money changers' tables. He literally turned them upside down. And so he uses that phrase here. He's saying that families are literally being turned upside down. There's division. They're wreaking havoc, not because of truth people will follow, but because of error. So you can only imagine the conflict and the emotion and the pain and the confusion and the anger that's taking place in these churches on the island of Crete over false teaching. Everything is this convoluted, confusing mess. It reminded me of a time a few years ago in Africa. I was speaking in a couple of different states there, and primarily in Kenya, where we're broadcast in Swahili, and I was there a week after Benny Hinn had come and held a citywide crusade. I mean, tens of thousands of people packed into the baseball stadium to hear him. I've never heard him in person, but he had promised this audience, I would learn later, that Jesus was going to appear on the stage one night that week. And he just built it up. He built it up. And finally on, I think it was a Thursday night, he turned and he looked and he began to go through all these motions about Jesus being there. And in a matter of about 6 or 7 seconds, Jesus was supposedly gone. And then he said, "Did you see him?" And I mean, people were fainting and screaming. It was bedlam. I was there a week afterward, and I was having lunch with two men who served as the secretaries of two major denominations in that part of Africa. And they were telling me about this. And they were telling me how their churches were now ripped with confusion and now even dividing local churches. And then the church at large dividing over his claim. Those members in the churches that believed Jesus appeared, and And those believers who didn't believe, Jesus appeared. Division was rife. Because of the false teaching, it was one confusing, convoluted mess. Paul describes here not only are families being turned upside down, but secondly, the bank accounts of these teachers are filling up. Look at verse 11 again. They're upsetting whole families, teaching things they shouldn't teach. Why? For the sake of sordid gain. Gain. That preposition, for the sake of, indicates that this is their goal. This is their motive. They are teaching what they are teaching for the sake of gain. This is what they're after. By the way, sordid gain can refer to money, but could also appear in a broader sense. Paul will use this in other passages to talk about power or prestige or fame. In other words, they want a following. It is for that purpose that they are teaching. So they can defraud as con artists. He's essentially saying here, these false teachers are not interested in feeding the flock, but fleecing the flock. Spiritual con artists. And Paul says to Titus, essentially, that the flock is always in danger of being misled. And so after setting the stage, he's going to talk about what it means to follow the roadmap, by the way, that you have, which is sufficient, right? It has given you the doctrine, the teaching that he says here, the faithful word, verse 9, which is in accordance with the teaching. It is with this body of apostolic truth whereby you rebuke and exhort and refute those who contradict. This is it. This is it. A news article I came across some time ago told the story of a family who spent Thanksgiving break in Seattle, Washington with extended family, and then afterward, after the holiday, began to make their way back, the long journey back to San Francisco, traveling by station wagon, James and Katie with their two young daughters. They traveled south on Interstate 5 for a while, and then late in the evening, they intended to exit on Highway 42, but they missed it. And instead of backtracking, they decided to follow a map somebody had given them, they couldn't remember who, that seemed to show a shortcut to the coast. The map was an errant map, and it didn't show that that particular road would be closed. After encountering snowdrifts too high to drive through, they turned off on a spur road. And after struggling for about 15 miles on this unpaved side road, they got stuck in a snowbank. They had lost track of where they were. Instead of attempting to hike out on foot, they decided to remain with the car and hope to be rescued. They remained there for several days, running their car intermittently for heat, eating sparingly the food they had. When the car ran out of gas, they burned magazines and scraps of wood they could find to keep warm. Finally, their food was gone, nothing more to burn. James decided to set out on foot. According to that map, there was a town about, he thought, 4 miles away. It was 15 miles away, and he never made it out alive. A search party eventually rescued his wife and girls who had survived. When I read that article, I couldn't help but think of the flock of God on her way. False teachers are standing at convenient places selling roadmaps that miss key information, that promise shortcuts to the coast. Easier, better, happier, healthier, faster. And all your wishes come true. Now. Don't be conned. Be careful. And you happen to hold a map without any missing information on what's needed to arrive one day safely home. Now, with that as the warning, he's going to turn the corner and he's going to talk about what it means to walk the right way according to this map as an older man, older woman, and younger man. And we'll pick it up there tomorrow morning. But in the meantime, do not read ahead. All right, Pastor?